WKLAV, Lou Epton.
All right, back we are, 26 before the top of the hour, and again, good morning. Lou Epton, as promised, our very special guest this morning, the incomparable Jordan Maxwell. As always, much to say, and as always, of great interest. Jordan, good morning.
Good morning, my friend Lou.
How are you?
Fine, sir.
All right. Now, you and I were talking on the phone yesterday about several different topics, and boy, I'll tell you, Jordan, some of them were pretty frightening, but I thought we'd pick up on something that I think is of great interest to a lot of people, because we still hear a great deal about, at the end of the war, the World War II, a word came into being that a lot of people hadn't heard, and that word was the Holocaust.
Yes, sir.
And
unfortunately, too many people that use that term do not fully understand the implications, one, of the term itself, and two, why it was used.
Well, now, wait a moment. The implications, I think, are fairly well known. They murdered millions of people.
And they burned them.
And they burned them.
And that's where we get the word Holocaust.
Well, how does... All right, put this together for me, if you would. I'll put it together for all of us.
Okay, now, what we just said was a third understanding, but the first two we still haven't touched. First of all, what is the reason or the motive or the concept of a Holocaust? What are you talking about?
Well, the understanding, I think, the preponderance of the people had was to get rid of an entire group of people.
Well, in point of fact, that's probably what was the motivating reason which brought on things like the Holocaust. But the point I'm making is that a Holocaust is a sacrificial, ritualistic burnt offering according to the Hebrew Old Testament. In the Old Testament, when Adam and Eve were told in Genesis, had their first two sons, Cain and Abel.
Yeah.
We are then told that Cain and Abel were to make sacrifices to God. And consequently, Cain made the sacrifice of vegetation on the altar and burned the vegetation on the altar as a sacrificial, ritualistic burnt offering to God. And Abel offered up a lamb or an animal, and killed the animal, burned the animal on the altar, and offered up the body, the burnt body, to God as a ritualistic, sacrificial, burnt offering.
Where do we find information like this? Because as the Bible tells it, at least my understanding is, Cain killed Abel, and it didn't go into a lot more detail, so
yeah,
obviously...
Well, the scripture says the reason why Cain killed Abel is because God let it be known that he favored and accepted Abel's sacrifice rather than Cain. In other words, God was not happy with the sacrificial, ritualistic burnt offering of the vegetation. He was far more happier and accepted Abel's sacrificial burnt offering of the lamb or the animal, and therefore it was a put down for Cain. It was a rejection of Cain. And by God, and so consequently he became inflamed against his brother and struck out at him, which is human. You get mad, you strike out at someone, but in this case we're told he killed his brother.
Well, now, wait a moment. Let me ask you something very plainly. Do you believe this?
I think that it has some modicum of truth as long as you understand the symbolic meaning behind it. And the rabbis will tell you that the overwhelming majority of the stories in the Old Testament are a symbolic story, which is trying to tell you something.
Okay,
it's telling you something very important, but we who are ill-informed and unread on the ancient Hebrew traditions and culture of the Middle East of some 3,500 years ago, we take everything literally, And consequently, we missed the purpose of the story.
I've got a question I've asked a number of people over the years, and it's one that nobody, how do I say this, to my satisfaction is answered, logically anyway. Now, you've got two people on the planet, right?
Yes.
God created the world and all things on and in, and created Cain and Abel, okay?
Okay.
And then Cain killed Abel. And then the story goes on, Cain got married.
That's right.
Who in the world did he marry?
Okay, glad you asked.
Well, how could you not? If these are the only two people, according to Scripture.
Well, first of all, we don't know that they had sisters at the time that Cain is sent out from the garden. First of all, you have Adam and Eve,
okay,
and Cain and Abel.
Right.
Cain then kills his brother Abel,
right,
and God says, we can't have murderers in this household, so you have to leave. And then Cain makes an interesting statement to God. If you go back and read it, like Rabbi Entelman used to tell me, don't just thumb through it. Sit down and look at it and read it slowly and understand what's being said. Cain kills his brother, and God says you have to leave. The scripture says that Cain says to God then, don't send me out of the garden. Don't send me out, because they are going to get me. They're going to get me out there, and they will kill me if they find me.
In other words, there were other other life outside of the garden.
Absolutely.
Oh, well, that...
And consequently... God said, no, I'm not going to let them kill you. I'm not going to let them harm you. I will put a mark on you. It will be called the mark of Cain. And I will put a mark on you so that anyone out there who finds you will not harm you. Now now we have God believing there's somebody out there.
Well, not only that, if God was unhappy with what you had stated earlier, that Cain burnt leaves, and God preferred Abel sacrificing a lamb.
Yes, uh-huh.
Now, wait a moment. A lamb is a living creature. So Cain decided he would outdo Abel and killed Abel. What kind of a God? Or am I not supposed to ask a question?
Well, no, I think it's a very good question. It's rather controversial, but that's what Jordan Maxwell is all about, is controversy.
True.
But that's a very good question, because the whole idea is that, and let's go back to the very first question.
Uh-huh.
The whole idea of killing the animal and or getting the vegetation, putting something, living or whatever, on an altar and burning it, and offering it up as a sacrifice to God, in the Hebrew is called holocaust. The word holocaust means a sacrificial, religious, spiritual, sacrificial, ritualistic burnt offering to God. Now, first of all, ask the question, why does God require a sacrificial, ritualistic burnt offering?
And then I'm going to ask, do you think that the Nazis were offering a ritualistic...
burnt offering?
Thank you.
Yes.
Oh, come on. Come on. They were godless.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Not at all. They were very, very religious. And that is the perception that the National Socialists were godless. But in point of fact, they were extraordinarily religious and were dedicated to their religion to such a high degree that nothing would stand in the way of the fulfillment of their religious or spiritual destiny.
Well, now, wait. You never heard, you never saw anything religious in the portrayal of what went on in Germany when the Nazis took over. Everything was... Hitler became their local god, in effect.
Well, touche.
Well, this is an Austrian. He used to be a house painter or a paper hanger.
Yeah, it doesn't make you a bad person.
No, but he was,
I'm teasing you.
I understand that, but he was also a little off-center, wasn't he?
He did have a few problems.
Yeah. I think so.
And again, we go back to this concept of burning something on an altar. And today in churches, all churches have altars. And why? It's because there's a whole symbolism here that goes back to not just the Hebrew tradition and people and culture, but can go all the way back into Egypt, because every single culture that's ever existed on the earth, period, has always had the concept or the idea of an altar in which you offer up a sacrifice to a divine or a heavenly power of some sort. Now, the question is, why? Why would this divine, heavenly, Father, God, Creator require you to do this ritual? It's a ritualistic, sacrificial thing. What are you doing? Why are you burning something? And what is it that's going on here? Well, according to the Old Testament, and we're just going to look at that for the moment, it is a requirement by God. God requires that you do something to get his attention. And it's like a child, I can explain it like this, it's like a child coming to you and showing you a little picture or something that he has painted or drawn for you, or made some little something toy for you.
Mm-hmm.
Why? It's to get your attention and to get on your good side. Now that you are pleased that the child has thought of you enough to design this little thing for you as a present, now you are more kind-hearted toward him, and then he can now ask you for something. So this is what a sacrificial burnt offering was to God.
Yeah.
Is that you offer up something to God that will make him happy, that will show respect for him, and show an acknowledgement for his Godhead and Godship. And then after you have performed this ritualistic, sacrificial, burnt offering on the altar, and he is happy now you can ask God for a favor. It's like going before your parent and doing some nice thing, and then asking them if you can use the car.
On that, I'm going to hold you for a moment, because what I really wanted to lead us into is something you're very aware of. You're involved, well, maybe from a sideline, in one of the largest suits ever to go before a court involving the Holocaust.
That's exactly right.
Lou Epton, Jordan Maxwell is our guest. Stay with us. We're going to do this, and then we're coming right back. We're coming to you through the facilities of AM 1230 KLAV Las Vegas. 731-1230, that's the number, or toll-free if you're out of area, 1-866-820-KLAV. Hang in there. We'll be right back.
Nevada Broadcasters Hall of Fame with outstanding performance. It's Lou Epton.
All right, back we are, 10 before the top of the hour. Lou Epton, along with a very special guest of the morning, Jordan Maxwell. 731-1230, toll free at 1-866-820-KLAV. Jordan, give me a moment here, because before we go into the suit that you are working on from the sideline,
mm-hmm.
you made a comment that I think might be fairly interesting. You were telling me about three individuals who were working on the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Oh, yes.
You remember that?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I want you to have one of them. The other two are gone now, but there was one who was a very, very interesting man, profoundly interesting man, Dr. Robert Eisenman. And Dr. Eisenman, I had on my show here in Los Angeles, and he is just extraordinary, and his knowledge of the Dead Sea Scrolls will just knock you out. He was one of the original people working on the Dead Sea Scrolls for many, many years
mm-hmm.
in Israel. And then the controversy began when Harvard Divinity School was appointed back in 1948-49, whenever it was
mm-hmm.
that the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. Dr. Strugow was chosen by the State of Israel, the new State of Israel, England and America,
mm-hmm.
to be the man in charge of the Dead Sea Scrolls project, to read and see what these things were.
Yeah.
And so Strugow was appointed. His second that he appointed was John Allegro. John Allegro was a Britisher who was world-renowned for his work in the ancient Hebrew and the Jewish culture, tradition, Middle East, etc., etc.,
yeah.
and he was an expert. So Strugow appointed Dr.
Allegro?
Yeah, and consequently, later on down the line, Dr. Robert Eisenman comes into the picture, also in Israel, and he is also himself an expert, obviously, in this study. And consequently, when Stugau came out, all three of those men and everyone on the Dead Sea Scrolls Commission working on the scrolls, none of them ever publicly gave any kind of an interview ever, period. No one ever said anything. No one was allowed to say anything.
Yeah.
And they worked feverishly behind the scenes on the Dead Sea Scrolls, but no one was saying anything.
That would be Stugau, Allegro, and Eisenman.
Yes.
Okay.
And there were many others, excellent experts, but those were the three, the main ones at the moment.
Right.
At the beginning. And consequently, Stugau finally came out one day, which... from what all indications he was not supposed to do, and he knew it. And he gave a full-length interview to a magazine in Israel, which was comparable to our Time magazine. It was very, very well-read in magazine. And he did a whole interview. Well, that interview blew him out of the commission. He was fired, kicked out, sent back to America in disgrace, lost all of his standing... academic standing, was just totally ruined. He was finished.
That's interesting. Here's a man that was studying, along with others. He decided to give an interview, a public interview, even though he knew better. And as a result, they went after him.
He lost everything. Finished. Done. No more job. His academic standing was taken from him. He was removed from his position in the university at Harvard. He was bitterly destroyed.
Must have been a hell of an interview.
Oh, yeah. It was a knockout. Okay.
It had to have been. Was he telling factually what he had learned?
That's right. That's exactly right. And that was what we call telling stories out of school.
Ooh.
He was not allowed to talk about what they were finding. And he did, and he knew it. And I think he was bitter. I think he finally come to a point in his life where certain professional men do, when they say, enough is enough. That's it. I don't care what you do to me. This is I've had enough of your totalitarian dictatorship telling me what I can think. And, of course, Stugau was, he was the head man. He was appointed by the State of Israel.
Oh, boy.
And seconded by England and America.
Yeah.
So it was not, this was not a small thing. This was the man that was head of the whole commission. And so, consequently, when that happened to John Stugau, John Allegro, the second in command, watched what happened and said, well, if they're going to do that to the boss, I might as well give them an interview myself, and I might as well do it too,
Uh-huh.
And so he did. He gave an interview and started talking publicly, both in England and in Israel, and he got the same. Was publicly flogged and sent back to America and sent back to England and lost his position and was bitterly discovered that he lost everything. His academic standing, he was villainized as must be an alcoholic or mentally deranged or something, and that was it. He's finished. When in point of fact, he was the second man appointed by the State of Israel with the eyes of both England and America watching, and they would not have appointed these men had they not been the best of the best. And now, because they give public declaration about their work, immediately they're finished. Through. No more jobs ever.
I guess they didn't want the truth to come out then.
I guess not. And that's the State of Israel. That's America. That's England.
Well, that left Dr. Robert Eisenman.
And so Dr. Robert Eisenman... thinking, well, okay, they shot down two Gentiles. Let's see what they're going to do to me. So he came out and gave giving interviews, and boy, they went after him big time. And so he decided, as a last and final move, is to release all that was known about the Dead Sea Scrolls in English to the world. And it was Dr. Robert Eisenman who actually made the last and final step and released what we today now have in all the books on the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was Dr. Robert Eisenman who stood up against the power establishment in Israel, England, and America, and privately released all of the, you know, all of the Dead Sea Scrolls material.
Well, did he stay on after the other two had gone?
No,
he
thank
quit.
You. No, he was out.
Okay.
Came back to this country and was bitterly persecuted.
He too
lived
then,
here in Orange County.
And they went after him.
Oh, did they ever. Did they? And they are still after him. They've sued him out of existence. They're suing him for all kinds of clever and resourceful reasons. They're going after him from all directions.
In other words, the world should never know what they uncovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
You got it.
You got to wonder why.
Well, I think it's because, and you and I have been doing radio shows for some time, and I've been saying for a long time, if ever America is allowed to see the real truth about theology and religion and what the words mean, what the symbols mean, and go back and be intellectually honest and look at the Hebrew words and terms, you're going to find there's a whole world of knowledge you have never been privileged to know. And you know as well as I do how corrupt the media is, how corrupt government is, how corrupt the taxes are, how corrupt education is, and how corrupt the entire world system that we live under is. And we readily acknowledge all of that corruption. But it would never occur to you that there might even be that same depth of corruption right in the state of Israel, right within the religion of the Western world, Judaism and Christianity. There are secrets you don't know, and they will ruin your career if you do know and try and talk about it.
And they've got the power to do it, don't they?
I'm tired of that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, now, it's interesting to note how many American corporations were involved with the other side during World War II.
But don't take that personal. It was just business.
Right, Philbuck. Why would Rockefeller Standard Oil ship oil to Adolf Hitler at the height of the war? Why would IBM work with Adolf Hitler in helping him devise a system by which they could identify people?
Right.
How about General Motors? Were they involved as well?
Up to their neck.
Don't tell me they were building Jeeps for Germany.
Yeah, they were building all kinds of military transport vehicles. Ford Motor Company was building the half tracks.
Oh, come on. We were building armaments for our enemy?
Yeah, of course. It's good business. Look at big contracts are very, very lucrative. You don't care, like the mafia says. We don't care where we get the money as long as we do business. As long as you do business. Well, if you're killing Jews, well, who the hell cares? This is war. It's a business. Don't take things personal.
Oh, dear Lord.
Yeah.
You know, you hear these things, you don't want to believe them. You shake your head and you go, it just doesn't make sense. We lost a lot of good youngsters in
of
that
course.
War. And I guess life really to these corporate giants is so cheap that, like you say, who really gives a damn?
Nobody. Virtually nobody.
And their families.
You know, it's just amazing to me. I'll tell you what.
Who else was in? Now, wait, we've got Ford, General Motors, Eastman Kodak.
Yeah, Eastman Kodak made the bomb sights for Hitler to drop the bombs. You have to have those precision lenses on your bomb sights. Your binoculars by, Bausch & Lomb binoculars. The Bausch & Lombs were supplying all the binoculars, and today we wear Bausch & Lomb sunglasses, and we are so impressed with all the new technology for sunglasses and glasses, but we don't realize that all these companies were working for Adolf Hitler.
How could our government allow any company, American company of any size, now I'm talking the government, okay?
Yes.
How could they allow them to do business with our enemy?
Well, at that time, there was, in point of fact, there was a couple of good men that came out and they got passed something called, in Congress or in the government, they got something passed, or at least brought it up, called Trading with the Enemy Act.
Yeah.
And because it was well known that just about all of big American industry and all the little guys that support it were all supporting Adolf Hitler. And so there was a law that was introduced called Trading with the Enemy Act, and that was supposed to make it illegal to give Adolf Hitler bullets and guns and the gas to kill Jews and Gentiles around the world. And so, yeah, there were a couple of good people who introduced, but you know as well as I do, a couple of good men trying to do something like that, you might as well go home, and it's irrelevant, because international big business will crush you.
How about banks? What banks were involved, American banks were involved on the side of Adolf Hitler?
Oh, heaven. I mean, you have no idea. I mean, I'm not going to get into this right now, but so many of our major banks
were the
banking cartels which financed the money out of both America and England, out of Georgia, out of New York, out of Chicago. I'm not going to name the banks.
Why?
But it's there.
Why are you going to name them?
Let me give you an example. The reference works alone will tell you. Look at, there was a television show quite a few years ago with Robert Mitchum. One of his last big productions was a 7-week miniseries, I think, on NBC, but it was on one of the major networks.
Uh-huh.
And Robert Mitchum was the star, and it was called Winds of War.
I remember.
And we talked about this before on the show, but in that television miniseries, it's about Adolf Hitler, the Second World War, the U.S., etc. And in the movie, there's a scene where Robert Mitchum, who is representing as a high official the U.S. government, goes to talk to Adolf Hitler and see if the U.S. can mediate some kind of a proposition that the U.S. government wants from Hitler. And so they send Robert Mitchum. Well, he goes to the what they call the eagle's nest, or the up in the mountains, to visit Adolf Hitler. Now, this is in the movie called Winds of War.
Uh-huh.
And so he comes into this big room. He's invited to come into the room, and Adolf Hitler greets him at the door and brings him in. And he sees all these men sitting around in these big sofas around the fireplace. And Adolf Hitler brings him in and says, I want you to meet some of my friends. And he starts naming off the people sitting around the fireplace. Here's Mr. Giannini from the Bank of America, Mr. So-and-so from Standard Oil, Mr. So-and-so from the AT&T, American Telephone and Telegraph.
Oh, no.
You know, from the Bell Company, et cetera, et cetera. All of these are my friends. And but it's nothing personal. It's just business. And consequently, my question is, what is it that these men know that they don't care what he's going to do? They already know up front what he's doing. They're not stupid.
Yeah.
These guys are not foolish. I mean, this kind of power brokers are many things, but stupid is not one of them. They calculate every move. And if they know that Jews are going to be cremated and that people are going to die, and yet they're sitting there, sipping their wine and chit-chatting with Adolf, one must ask their question, what is American industry doing financing Adolf Hitler? Now, I realize that the subject is controversial, and most people couldn't care less.
Yeah.
And that's why these people get away with it, because the great American public are only concerned about football, their belly, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And one day, we're going to get around to asking, who was doing what to who, and what in the hell is this word Holocaust?
Yeah.
What is the implications of a sacrificial burnt offering?
Yeah. Okay, we're going to have
Jewish authorities are trying to tell you something in a very cryptic and symbolic way. They're telling you something was going on here.
Okay, we're going to have to hold up for a little bit. Let's do this time out, and then we'll come back with you and with a lot more. Lou Epton here with Jordan Maxwell, 731-1230, toll-free 1-866-820-KLAV. We will entertain your calls right now. Hear this, and then we'll be back.
So often, the only place you're going to hear it is right here on the Lou Epton Show.
At 10 minutes after the hour, hello again. Back we are. Lou Epton, along with a very special guest this morning, Jordan Maxwell. Again, our number is 731-1230, toll-free 1-866-820-KLAV. I don't know about anybody else. So let me just ask, how does it make you feel, those of you who had friends and or relatives in your background that were involved in fighting the Axis powers. To find out, people like Ford Motor, General Motor, Standard Oil, Eastman Kodak, Bosch and Lomb, AT&T, Bank of America, and how many other of these banksters, and how many other corporations? How about Chrysler Company? Were they involved as well?
No, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. It's just business.
It goes on and on. And they were there on Hitler's side.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well. Okay.
As a matter of fact, Lou, I'll bet you didn't know that John F. Kennedy's father, Joe Kennedy, who was obviously one of the biggest mafiosi gangsters the country had ever produced up to that time, Ted Kennedy and the Kennedy clan. Well, the father of the Kennedy boys was a top-of-the-line gangster. He was a...
Oh, I know. He was involved in running liquor.
Booze and women and all kinds of other nefarious activities we haven't even heard of yet.
Yeah.
And he was picked by Roosevelt to be ambassador to St. James's Court in England, and to be the ambassador to England for the United States. And they asked Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, why in the world would he have picked Joe Kennedy for anything in the government when he's known for who he really is? And Roosevelt said, look it, the whole world is run by gangsters, so I want one of the best that we got in there at the table, you know.
Oh,
looking out for it.
Just out of curiosity, were any of these same companies doing business with Japan during the war?
Oh, absolutely. They were there, and all of the Nazi sympathizing countries and and friends that were helping Hitler, like Shell Oil Company, major. I've got pictures, color pictures from research and magazines. Shell Oil and Standard Oil and their train, the oil tankers in Germany with the huge big symbols on the side of the tanker saying Shell Oil, Standard Oil, delivering. And the article was talking about how if it wasn't for Shell and Standard Oil and some of the American oil giants, Hitler would have been up the creek. He needed the oil for the war, and Shell Oil Company, that wonderful bastion of righteousness, Shell Oil, supplying Adolf Hitler and the Nazis with the material they need, with the gas and oil. So the next time you drive by a Shell, just check it out. Remember, Shell got to be very big. Standard Oil got to be very big. The Rockefellers got to be very powerful.
Oh, boy.
Why? Because of big government contracts. Big contracts to supply both sides of the war. There's a lot of money there, and so the next time you see these big corporations and big important corporations in America, just remember how they got to be big. They got the big contracts to sell to the enemy to kill your Jewish friends. But try not to let that bother you and take it personal, because it's just business.
All right, you're involved from whatever position.
Yeah.
In what I understand is really a very humongous-sized lawsuit. Would you tell us a little about that?
One of my dear friends is involved in a lawsuit. He's Jewish, and his family was involved in the Holocaust and the all of that stuff that was going on. And he decided to initiate a lawsuit, and it was the very first lawsuit initiated by a Jewish family against the American industry and the European partners for reparations and for getting the monies and gold and materials back to the families that it was stolen from.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, we've been hearing all about that.
Yeah.
And so this individual was the man who actually started that kind of thing. And the attorneys in New York and his family out here have been asking me to help them researching this whole subject,
mm-hmm.
to nail this thing down. Who were these companies? Where are the documents? So while most of Mr. and Mrs. America couldn't care less about this, it's just business, there are some very clever and well-informed Jewish attorneys in New York who are very concerned about this and are calling me and sending me letters and wanting me to help them put together this case, and it's an extremely extraordinary turn of events, as far as I'm concerned, but I'm glad somebody's doing something, and so I'm doing whatever little bit I'm able to do, but I think it's interesting they come to me.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, when this much money is involved, and this kind of a incredible story is being openly looked at in law, now they come, now that doesn't matter who's going to be offended and whose religious convictions are going to be offended. The attorneys in New York want to know, what is the real truth? What was really going on here?
Yeah.
Where did the money go? Who put it up? And nail this thing down for sure in a lawsuit. And so I have suggested in places to look and information for them to follow up on. So I'm kind of like helping them to open up and pull up all the rocks so they can see all the dark places.
Do you think this kind of a lawsuit will stand a chance going after giant corporations?
I don't know, but I think it's the right thing to do. It's David up against Goliath again.
Yeah.
You know? But who knows?
Okay, let's get back on track a little
no.
bit.
We'll
do, yeah, hold on, because I don't want to get started and have to interrupt you again.
Okay.
Let's do this timeout, and then we'll go with now and forward. Fair enough?
Right, though.
Okay, Lou Epton, Jordan Maxwell. Coming to you through the facilities of AM 1230 KLAV Las Vegas, 731-1230, 1-866-820 KLAV, and we'll be right back.
There's only one, and he's here on KLAV 1230, Lou Epton.
All right, back we are. What is it, 21 after the hour? Yep. Lou Epton with Jordan Maxwell, 731-1230, toll free, 1-866-820 KLAV. And when we last heard from Jordan Maxwell, he was saying, now. And then I had to interrupt. I'm sorry, Jordan. We were talking a lawsuit that is being put together to go after these giant American corporations for their involvement in World War II on the other side. Now, where do we go from here?
Well, they are kind, but you didn't specify which kind. Anyway, let's move on to go back to the subject of were the Nazis religious.
Okay.
Because it ties directly into Holocaust. The Nazis were very religious. They were an extremely religious group. But because they didn't use the terms and the symbols and the things which we in America are used to using,
Consequently,
we assume they must have been atheist or whatever, and they weren't religious. Well, that shows you how much we know. The Christians, actually, in the first century, this is a fact of history, The Christians in the first century, Rome called them atheists. Christians were referred to in history as atheists by the Romans. Why? Because the Christians did not worship the Roman gods. And obviously, anybody that's in Rome that does not worship the Roman gods must be atheists.
Yeah.
No, they just happened to have a different concept of God, and therefore you couldn't say they were atheists. They were very religious. They just don't worship your God.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing is true of the Nazis. Obviously, they didn't have all of the accoutrements of our religious establishment in North America, so obviously they weren't religious. Oh, in point of fact, they were very religious. You just don't understand their theology. And consequently, the swastika itself was a very important religious symbol, theological symbol. The reason, and we've talked about this God knows how many times, about why the color black was so prominent for the men in black. Today we have men in black in this country. You know, the black robes of judges and black robes when you graduate from university and the black robes of Catholic priests and all officials and all of these different institutions on there, they always are wearing black robes. And most people have never even thought about it, and that's happily just as well, because it might disturb you if you knew why people in this country wear black robes and what is it connected and why is it connected and how to the Nazi religion. And when you see these kids walking around on the street with something called a bowl haircut, And they think it's, you know, clever when you go to especially high school, the kids have got the